Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 241, featuring the legendary Rob Legato, visual effects supervisor extraordinaire, who has won three of the last of the four Oscars that he has been nominated for, including Titanic, Hugo, and Jungle Book. And in fact, he is more recently, he is the visual effects supervisor on The Lion King, which just came out, and obviously getting a lot of news in terms of the amazing work that they've done there, as well as the incredible workflow in virtual production. But Kristen, you listen to this podcast, and I know that Titanic is one of your favorite films. Am I right?
Yes, all-time favorite.
All right. Well, cool. What are some of the other things that that you heard that you were interesting in this that you liked about the podcast?
So I thought it was cool that when he saw Pinocchio when he was young, that it inspired his love for creating images. And then he also basically taught himself everything he learns by doing and problem solving. Mm-hmm. So if people show him, he's like, no, I got to do it myself. So he kind of follows his own directions. And
yeah, it's really cool mm-hmm. that he does that. In fact, he spends a lot of time behind the camera. That's really how he started. Which is really a very important skill that he brings. Not as many people in the visual effects world do that. In fact, he is a second unit director on a lot of films. He's done second unit for Scorsese and a bunch of other people. So really pretty cool to be, you know, as hands-on as he does, which is probably what led him to do so much work in the virtual production world. And we talk about virtual production for a long time, especially towards the end of the podcast. But really, really cool. I think that, you know, the thing that he does, you know, especially on The Lion King when he was working with Ben Grossman and those guys from Magnopus and Caleb Deschanel, who was the DP on it, really sort of understanding that workflow. So really cool to have Rob on. I really appreciate him coming by the studio and recording this incredible podcast. We have a couple of events, my faithful producer. What's going on this September?
All right. So you can find out about all these events at chaosgroup.com/events. Mm-hmm. One of the first ones coming up is on September 13th in Amsterdam. We have the IBC and Intel event, which is for the Visual Cloud Conference.
Yep.
On September 22nd in Kiev, we have the CG event, which is a Chaos Group sponsored celebration. Mm-hmm. And then we have our debut Chaos Meetup in Berlin, which will be on September 23rd.
Oh, okay, great. Mm-hmm. And I will also be going to Malta for THU. As you guys know, I go there every year. It'll be from September 22nd to the 29th. I will be recording a whole bunch of podcasts there. So if you guys are there, let me know. I'd love to hang out and see you guys. Okay, that's it for events. Want to remind a couple of people of where they can follow us. Where can they go?
So you can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. We also actually, I should mention that we do have a podcast page, which is chaosgroup.com/CG-garage as well. But you know, if you go onto Facebook, you know, please, you know, make sure you, you know, let us know if you have any ideas or things like that. So it's a good place to interact with us. But they can also, where can they also get our podcast as well?
So you can do it anywhere you get your podcasts, including Spotify, which is becoming very, very popular.
Yeah, very mm-hmm. popular, which is cool. I think it's interesting the way that Spotify is sort of working into the podcast world. Just from me as a podcaster, I'm getting very interested in Spotify as well. They can also email us if they have any ideas. Where can they do that?
So just go to labs, or you just email labs@chaosgroup.com.
Right.
And we can let us know any guests that you'd like to hear.
Exactly. Exactly. I just want to remind people that I do the podcast in person. So if you have a guest that's somewhere way far away from Los Angeles or where I happen not to be, then I usually will not be able to do the podcast. But if you know the guest that's coming to Los Angeles or is in Los Angeles, please let us know. Or if you know that I'm going to an event like going to THU, let me know as well. And if there's someone there that I should interview, I will definitely do that. Also want to make sure that people know if they're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, and I know a lot of you are, please leave us a review there and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear you know, your thoughts on the Apple Podcasts as well. All right, guys, thank you so much. Hopefully you will enjoy this great podcast with the legendary Rob Legato.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
This is really a great honor to have you here. I really appreciate it. The first time that I heard you talk was at the when we were at the Bake Offs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. So I don't remember which movie. I think it might have been The Aviator. Was that?
Yes, Aviator was right. Was one of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember your talk, and you have a very very good way of sort of engaging the audience and talking to them about the process of what the stuff you guys do. So I've really appreciated that, and I've heard of you for a long, long time. I worked at DD for many years, so I've heard a lot of the amazing stories on Titanic and a lot of those things. But
some were infamous stories.
Some of them are infamous stories, and we can talk about whichever you want to. But I'd love to know a little bit about how you got into this. How did you get into visual effects? Where did it all start with you?
Well, I didn't mean to. It just sort of happened that way, and it happened. I'll give you the short version of the long story. I always was interested in movies when I was a kid.
Yeah,
and when I was 4 or 5 years old, saw Pinocchio with my dad, and I've never seen anything like it, and I was as fascinated with the projection beam as I was with the image that was on the screen.
It's right.
Like there's some kind of magic of how it goes from there to there
right.
that it was worth me in my little brain trying to figure out. And so I was always kind of interested in not just what that was, but how it was presented and created. So when I was growing up, I was always interested in photography and the magic of literally a dark room, and you put some light on a white piece of paper and all of a sudden it just shows up.
Yeah.
There's a magic quality to the process. So that was in the back of my mind, and I saw The Godfather.
Yes.
And it was just, mind-blowing epiphany of, I don't know what that is, but I want to do that. I can't even tell you who does what, but I can only intune from the credits, the cinematographer, who sounds like a photographer.
Right.
I didn't even know what cinema, that was.
Right.
Was responsible for the way it looked. And so I became fascinated with that, and I wanted to be able to do films like The Godfather.
Right.
And I went to Brooks Institute in Santa Barbara to study cinematography, because I figured you have to know that before you're even allowed to make any kind of movie. So that was my bias.
Okay.
So then I worked at a commercial company. After I graduated, we did McDonald's commercials and things like that, and I was the live action producer. So okay. I had nothing to do with visual effects whatsoever, and no particular interest besides the illusion of stuff like a magic trick. You have a cursory interest in it, but not a vocation in it.
Sure.
And one commercial came up one day where we needed to do something mm-hmm. that we couldn't hire somebody like me to do it, because there weren't people like me that readily available.
Okay.
There was ILM maybe, but that was about it.
Right.
And so I wanted to figure it out, because it was a challenge, and I did figure it out. And I asked for about 20 minutes of stage time. Just let me loose for 20 minutes mm-hmm. and let me see if I could do it, if I could pull it off.
Okay.
And I did. And then
what was the trick you were trying to pull off?
Okay, here was the trick, and I used. Are you familiar with Intravision? That process. Mm-hmm. It was front screen projection setup, and they would have a piece of glass that would be in front of it, and they could etch things, put the front projection material, and do like a mat where somebody would be behind. An object that was in the plate.
Okay.
So that you could like sandwich somebody in, and the film quality was very high. So I figured, well, I could probably do that on blue screen.
Okay.
Knowing very little about the blue screen process and what the gag was terrible. I mean, a stupid idea, but
right.
it was a Toyota commercial where a guy is standing next to a car mm-hmm. and he jumps up and magically goes through the roof, lands in the driver's seat.
Okay.
Turns to the camera and says, "Now beat that." Like, he did this thing.
Right.
And no one knew how to figure it out how to do it. So I got blue screen, the live Ultimat, and then a piece of glass, and I had the art director. I can't draw, so I had the art director
right.
paint the outline of the car, so when you photographed it, it looked like he got behind the car.
The car,
and
right.
so he was like sandwiched into a live mat.
Got it.
This way, because it was blue in the foreground, and then he was in the middle of it.
Right.
So, and it worked. It was just like, and the guy who was hired kind of to bring all the equipment told everybody it can't work. It's like, I don't know why exactly.
Okay.
That's the story of my career, is people
sure.
tell me that things can't work. So we told everybody, can't work. And then, you know, the agency was upset. And, you know, then all of a sudden it was like, well, that was it. And then the cameraman was impressed. He said, you should work at a company called Bob Abel and Associates.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to direct commercials, and I was really difficult. I didn't have a lot of money. I couldn't, like, make up my own sample reel or anything. And it's hard to get a job without having a job.
Yep.
So I said, okay, well, maybe that's my way in. Mm-hmm. And because I had live action experience, a lot of people at Bob Abel and Associates did not have any live action experience.
Okay.
So they were a little foreign to what the crew does and who the gaffer is and the cameraman does and all that stuff. So I produced it, and then I'd sit in meetings and we'd say, okay, how are we going to do this? And somebody would say one thing or another, it didn't make any sense. And another guy was just known for just saying, no, something won't work, just right off the bat. And
right.
I got pissed off at a certain point. Everything can't be no.
Right.
Something has to work. So I embarrassed him in a meeting, and then it was now on me to now produce, do something. So I was like, all right, screw it. I'll go down. They have cameras, and I'm a cameraman, so... Mm-hmm. I put the thing together and it worked.
Right.
And I didn't mean to do it to say, well, I want to do it. It was just to prove a point. I was the producer. You guys are supposed to know how to do this sort of stuff. And I, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, you know how to do it. It's like, well, I was showing you. It wasn't like I want to do this. I just was. And then it's like, well, Bob has this problem. He's doing this commercial and, you know, he needs to get this thing figured out. Can you figure it out? It's like, oh, I have no idea. I mean, I don't do this for a living, but I'll look at it. And it was like, well, I guess I would do this and I would do that. And I'd look at Cinefex magazines and go, well, they did that. And so, you know, I was essentially producing the problem with me being the active participant just by researching it. And I sort of became known for doing that. And it was getting in the way of my career. I just wanted to shoot The Godfather if I could. And and instead I'm doing this goofy stuff that and then I discovered too, because of my journey and studying, that the directors, especially at the time, had no idea what any of this stuff was or how to do it. And so the normal visual effect way is you ask the director what he wants, and then he tells you something, and you write it down and try to produce what he does. And my thing was, he doesn't know what he wants. He has no clue. So I will act like I'm directing the commercial and what I would want to do, and then present what I think is the solution to the problem of the commercial, not this guy's particular vision, especially because I would notice he didn't have one.
Right.
You know, it'd be like, I'm thinking that we want to do wide and tight. You know, it's like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. Okay, forget it. Don't even embarrass yourself.
Right.
Let me come up with something and let me show you.
Okay.
And so, and then became sort of fun for me because now I was solving that problem. What is the problem of the story? How do you tell the story?
Right.
And so I was able to answer my own questions by, if I were him or her, what would I want this to be? Where would I shoot this? Why would I take advantage of this and not that? And I've always a big history buff on movies, so I had a kind of collection of memories of things that were impressive before the internet, where you could actually just have easy access to this sort of thing. And I had every book that I could possibly find on how to make movies, not the manuals, but the like books on how they made a particular film and that kind of thing. Not the you know, like the script writing books. So I did all that. And then, you know, you get good at it after a while. I mean, it's practice. And I became known or assume that I could work with difficult people that people have a hard time communicating with.
Okay.
Mostly because I didn't communicate with them. It's like, well, I think I know what you want and I'll go do it. And my film career has kind of been a little bit like that. It's like, you know what? Don't tell me too much. Let me go figure something out. And then now I give you a hole. Tell me if I'm on the right track or not. And generally you kind of are on the right track because you're putting yourself in the filmmaker's shoes to figure out a filmmaking problem, a storytelling problem. And if you do and you come up with something, that becomes the way to do it. And I was never a good short order cook. You know, if you tell me five things in a row, I would forget the first four. And then I also discovered I have I wouldn't call it a learning disability. It's a learning, you know, difference than other people. Uh-huh. There's the people who are verbal. Mm-hmm. They can hear auditory. They can hear, and then they follow the instructions. I can't do that.
Right.
Then there's visual, which seems like I would be that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sort of that's a little better. But then there's, I think it's called kinesthetic, I think it's what it's called. Kinesthetic learning, and that's like a 10% of the population.
Yeah.
Like 60 or 70% is auditory, then the visual is and then the smallest portion is what I have.
Okay.
Where you have to do it. It's like, well, you couldn't tell me how to open this up. I would have to pick it up with my hands, look at it, and then figure it out. That's the only way I could learn it.
Okay.
But you describing it to me or showing me a picture, I just couldn't do it. So my job essentially becomes I do hands-on work. I look through the camera, I move the stuff around, and that's my ability to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So following directions from somebody else becomes a very difficult challenge for me.
Yep, I understand.
But following my own, very easy. So that's kind of the long, short story.
Right. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I think that obviously visual effects is a problem solving role, right? Immediately. I always joke about it when I was doing VFX on commercials, mm-hmm. my favorite part of it was the bidding time, mm-hmm. because in the bidding time, that's when you're like trying to figure out, mm-hmm. because sometimes they'll tell you a description of something. It's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And then you're like, well, what if we did this instead? And then suddenly the bid becomes not a short order menu, but a collaboration of creativity. Mm-hmm. And you try to manually figure it out or whatever. I 100% agree with you on that. It's about working with the people and coming up with solutions together.
Yeah, and they're storytelling solutions. And that's what impressed me when I see the Godfather films that I like.
Sure.
Is what they're doing on every scene is figuring out the best way to tell that story, even if it's in close up or it's an over, and it's the way the light works, or the way the music works, or the way the camera moves, or the way the actors interpret the scene. And they have solved that storytelling problem by the way they stage it and the way they shoot it. So that was it was kind of easy for me to at least come up with an idea or how I would do it, how I would tackle it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my bent on that kind of work is doing it that way.
Sure. Well, I think it's a really good approach, obviously, and it's led you to many different ways. But how did you go from Bob Abel's studio to working on things like Titanic? What was that?
Okay, the next chunk of it was because I became good at this, and then I worked at a company that I would put these things together called CIS. That was the precursor of eFilm.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so they had a pin register rank. Mm-hmm. And so, and it cost $1,700 an hour and run at 2 frames a second. So you had to be pretty buttoned up when you transferred your elements and knew exactly how to line them up. And it was different than an optical lineup. It was essentially a time code digital lineup. And I was fairly organized because I had a budget that I couldn't, if I was an hour off, that's might exceed the budget or whatever. So I had to be buttoned up about it. So I was decent at it, and I knew how to put stuff together. I knew how to shoot everything because I would photograph all the elements, and then I knew how to line them up and all that stuff.
Okay.
So they were impressed by that in comparison to other people, and there was a person or a project that they were working on in TV, and it was just starting for TV to start to use the idea of what we did in commercials all the time.
Okay.
And they were disorganized because they give them like a roll of film, and it's like, it's in there somewhere. Find the shot.
Right.
And it was like, well, that's $1,700 an hour, going at 4 frames a second to find something they've never seen before.
Right.
And they suggested to the producers of Twilight Zone, you should talk to somebody like me because he knows how to take advantage of what we do and not cost a fortune. So I got an interview with Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who was there needed to help anyway because it's too much work to do for one person anyway. So I did every other show. And so I had a very unique set of skills, which is I knew live action.
Yeah.
I could be on a set and communicate very easily with everybody. Mm-hmm. And I also knew the directors didn't know a bunch of stuff about what they were doing, so I could fill in the blanks and they felt secure. So it was that. And then I knew essentially what amounts to digital post-production.
Right.
And probably it was more analog post-production at the time. But at any rate, it was digitally. And so I had a very unique set of skills. And then I also now worked on a TV show. So that went away. And then Star Trek happened. At the same exact time, they wanted to take advantage of and not do opticals like they did on the old show, but now do whatever one can take advantage of here.
Right.
So there was not too many people who had my set of skills that knew live action, had TV experience, did all digital production, and was a visual effects supervisor of some kind. I wasn't even called that at the time. I just did stuff.
Okay.
I don't even know what you call it, but I just did stuff. And because I was a cameraman, I knew how to light the blue screens and all the various things, and could get my way essentially with cameramen and things like that, because I could talk the language. And so I got to do that, and I like to do second unit and shoot and whatever, direct. That's what I wanted to do anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I became the second unit director on Star Trek, and I did all the stuff. And then I would take advantage of things by shooting miniatures at my house. You know, yeah. that you know, we couldn't afford to do this, and it was a union thing. I was like, you know what, I'll just shoot at my house, and I could shoot that. And I started doing a lot of that stuff. And then I started shooting all the motion control ship shots that were supposed to go to ILM, but they cost too much. By the time you talk to them, create a storyboard of what the shot was, budget it, thing, you know, it's like, well, you've just outstripped your week that you have to do it. And so I'll just shoot it. Okay. And it was like, at the time, it seemed like it was only ILM could do this magic, you know, ship shooting. And I did. And all of a sudden, I was able to shoot like a lot of ship shots and things. So it caught the attention of other people on the lot. And a friend of mine, Brooke Breton, left. She worked with me on the first season of Star Trek, and she moved on to other feature stuff. And then when Digital Domain came about, she said, we should talk to this guy, because he was clever enough. He could do things on his own and figure stuff out. Again, that kinesthetic learning, I would just shoot it myself because it was the easiest thing. So I got an interview with Jim Cameron and Stan Winston and Scott Ross, and my pure luck, because again, now I was in a position, features were starting to go away from opticals and be taking advantage of this. So I had this unique set of skills that were not that common, and it kind of leveled the playing field. I wasn't Ken Ralston or anything like it, but I had something that, you know, ILM was just learning how to do. So I was a viable candidate. And then we're bidding on Interview with the Vampire. And I got along with Neil Jordan because I didn't talk in a very technical way. Sure. It was like, yeah, I think if we just shot it this way, and some solutions to things were not an effect at all. It's like, well, we could shoot it in camera and do this and do that, because I like doing that more than I like doing composite work. And so he hired me to be the supervisor and then be the second unit director on Interview the Vampire. Nice. So an Interview the Vampire went from kind of a lower budget idea. As soon as Tom Cruise got involved, then it went from a $25 million movie to a $60 million movie. And then the mandate was, well, where you have a $60 million movie, you better look like a $60 million movie, do stuff, you know, make stuff.
Right.
So it became now a bigger deal. So I never would have gotten that job had it been the Interview of the Vampire as it became, it's a $2 million, you know, visual effects budget for, you know, we could take a chance and not kill ourselves. And then, you know, that caught the attention of Ron Howard and Brooke knew him when Apollo 13 was coming about, and it was supposed to go to ILM, and from other factors that are more akin to, well, it was easier because it's down here and they have an office not far away. It'd be more convenient. And the guy seems like he knows some stuff. So maybe we'll not go and do ILM. Maybe we'll do this. Right. And so I got the gig.
Nice.
And then Jim saw it. And, you know, like I do everything, I try to make it sequence-based storytelling and not a shot that you just, you know, it was one shot after another that you kind of paste together. It was like each shot was meant in a rhythm to flow together. And he caught that when I was doing the launch and I did a couple other sequences where he was like, well, it feels like it's still part of the story. It doesn't feel like we're now cutting to the visual effects sequence and then we cut out of it and do the rest of the story. It feels like you're telling the story all in one piece. Mm-hmm. So would you do Titanic? And I was like, well, I'm not going to say no.
Right.
And so that's how I went from that bizarre path to then Titanic, and then, you know, Apollo 13, we got nominated for Academy Award, and we got a lot of attention and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I essentially got a career that I still wanted to just shoot The Godfather if I could, but I kept on getting involved in these other things and figuring out these problems. And then, you know, it quelled a little bit of my, you know, my other desires by being able to shoot second unit and I studied cinematography. So I found that it was much easier for me to shoot my own stuff than ever hiring an additional cameraman, because I still wanted to look the way I wanted to look. And it's like there's like a middleman in that particular case.
Right.
And so then eventually I would just say I was the second unit director of photography as well. Mm-hmm. And I got caught in New York. I was doing, I think, Good Shepherd. And I was got caught in New York. And the guy said, are you in the union? It's like, no. And he goes, you would like to be in the union. And I said, yeah, I think I would. He goes, no, you would like to be in the union is what I'm telling you. And it's like, I guess I would. And so now I, and then it was good for me. And honestly, because I do love that, that now I could work on any lot and be the director of photography. And I, and everything I've ever done, I shoot second unit and on Hugo and all the other films and Jungle right. Book and everything else and Lion King and I could be legal and shoot anywhere. Right. I did one film. I won't say what the film is or the people involved, but I was hired as a second unit director because of the work I did, but they had a union cameraman on the lot that they were using. Uh-huh. And I had a terrible experience because I couldn't get what I wanted very well. And it soaked up a lot of my directorial time. So I couldn't get all the shots and the sequences the way I like. So it was like, I'm never doing that again. I'm going to photograph my own work because as I figure out, I'm a little right brain, left brain. Mm-hmm. So as I figure out the shot, the other brain is also figuring out how to do it. So right. my solution is immediately based on the, what I wanted to do and then how I would do it. And then, you know, I could figure out, you know, from my live action experience producing, how to figure out the day, what's the most efficient way to move the chess pieces around to maximize your, sure, your day. Sure. So it fit into every skill that I have.
Yeah.
That's how I got, that's how I did that. And then I was lucky enough, Neil Jordan said, you want to be the second unit director? It's like, of course awesome. I do. And I got to shoot some really cool stuff and I was delighted. And
yeah. So it's really great. I think, I mean, obviously I know you've worked, you've done a lot of second unit work, obviously, but you've done it for a lot of really big directors. I mean, you're very well, you know, obviously you work with Scorsese quite a bit. You know, you work with Ron Howard and Jim Cameron, you know, a lot of the big directors, and the second unit is like some of the most challenging technical things out there, right? That's the whole point of second unit is the challenge of what that is. So really great, great stuff and great stories. What is it like to work as a second unit for those guys? And how do-
it depends on the person. You know, I'm a huge fan of Marty, right. Martin Scorsese, and when I work with him, we have a nice sort of understanding of, you know, here's the stuff that he likes to do, that he likes to concentrate and be present for,
right.
And here's some stuff that, you know what, I don't need to be, but I also need my sensibility to be there.
Right.
So I established with him my sensitivity to his work would be imparted in what I was shooting for him. And so he didn't have to outline it like, here's a shot-by-shot shot list of what I want. Mm-hmm. Is, let me tell you what I'm hoping to get. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're very specific shots, sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's just, here's, you know, the opportunity and fill it.
Right.
I'm a studier. So, you know, I'd study previous films that other people did and things like that. And in the case, Marty. And so my sensitivity to the shot was filtered through how it fits in. And my visual effects experiences, whatever I'm doing needs to look invisible. It can't look like somebody else was out there, you know, trying something. Not that I don't put my own spin on it, because I do, mm-hmm. but my spin is kind of, I really like the cinema of it. Like Bob Zemeckis is a really good cinematic director.
Yes.
The way the camera moves and the flow and the stuff. And I steal from everybody I've ever worked with. So
sure.
And Marty definitely likes that. So when you show him something that has a cinema bent to it, he's really interested in it. For me, it was very fulfilling to do it. And especially when you get somebody like a Marty to like what you did.
Sure.
And then when you see it on the screen and it feels like no one could tell the difference between what's the second unit scene and what's the first unit scene. And he'd give me some dialogue scenes to shoot and
right.
do. And if he liked what I did, it'd be in the movie. And that's the highest compliment. So
Each
one's a little different. What I found that was works for me that maybe doesn't necessarily work for other people is that they kind of get that I'm on their side and on their wavelength. I'm not trying to make my own movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like all good directors, it's like, well, tell me how your interpretation, tell me what you do. And then if I like it, I'm going to use it like an actor.
Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, like even the Jim Camerons, who are the kind of the micromanagers of every moment of their film, still wants a little give. You know, if you have something, share it. I'll use it.
Right.
If I like it, if I don't like it, I won't use it. And the confidence of those directors, Marty is the same way. It's like, you know, there's no ego problem here, because if I don't like it, it doesn't go in my movie. It's not right. Like you're trying to do something. So there's an openness to doing that. And when you work with secure people, you can do anything, including make a mistake and fix it, and everything's okay. When you work with insecure people, it's really much more difficult. So the secure directors I've worked with welcome the ideas and the addition and encourage it without if there's a shot they don't like, just fix it. I don't like that. Do this. And
that's how they became good directors.
That's how they become good directors. And it's how how you become a good director of actors. It's like, I thought that you should read it this way, but you came up with another way. Way more interesting, because you studied acting for 20 years and you thought the character should do this, and you probably gave it more thought than I did as a director. So give me that. And the Martys of the world and the people that are like that, they dig for your individual contribution. Mm-hmm. And just shape it and guide it, but they use it. And that's why their movies are so good.
Yeah,
they do that. So, so in that particular realm, all the work I've done with these kind of heavy hitter directors has usually been, very pleasant and collaborative and because we don't make a big deal. I always loved when I worked with Neil Jordan it would be he and I on the edge of the set trying to figure out how we're going to shoot something. Mm-hmm. And there was no committee. There was no, you have to get it okayed by anybody. We just talk about it and we just go shoot it. And it was just like, and then it was very exciting because it was collaborative. And then I would say, I would do this, and he wasn't following what I was talking about. And then he'd see it go, oh, but what if we did that? It's like, that's better. And that's the kind of the tag on my idea.
Sure.
Or I do the reverse. And he didn't have an ego about it. So it was perfectly fine to go, come here, I have a problem with this scene. Tell me what you think. And we go and then walk onto the set and shoot it.
Right.
Without any fanfare, not storyboard it out or figure it out or do whatever. And so I've had, pretty good experiences with very secure filmmakers who appreciate what you give them if you give them something good.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. I think that again, that getting that confidence to work is really good. And sometimes you don't need a committee. Committees can be bad.
They're bad. Committees are really bad because they're second guessers. And what I found that works great in the film
business. There's also a lot of people want to put their finger in the pie,
Yeah, and they don't want to take the blame for it though.
Right.
And that's what you discover too, is that they want to feel like in the meeting they made a point. But they don't want to be pegged for making the point that doesn't work. So, it's like, it's sort of like if don't go fishing if you don't like fish. I mean, don't invite a conversation if you don't really want the conversation to take on a committee decision that now we have to do what the committee decided, because usually it's at cross purposes with one another and it never. I mean, the famous George Lucas line, I don't know if he coined it or repeated it, was a camel is a racehorse designed by a committee. And that's kind of exactly what it is. It's like, here's this beautiful, incredible animal, and let's add all our little bits and pieces to it, and you end up with something that looks like a camel. So, and that's why, the secure people don't want the massive amount of input from other people, because other people are not sitting and trying to figure out that one cinematic problem that with style and elegance creates the solution, and all the style and elegance of every shot becomes The Godfather, becomes your favorite movies and things like that.
Do you think there's more committees now than there's been in the past?
There are. An interesting thing, and hopefully it doesn't alter, is that now with like the Netflix and things like that, they rely on filmmakers. That's why all of a sudden there's this rash of really good work, good television work. It's like, here's the money and here's the slot. Make me something good. We don't know about the film business enough to criticize every aspect of the work, or we don't have a TV cue that an actor has to look like this and do this. And we have charts and focus groups. We don't have any of that. We just have our gut level. And it kind of goes back to the original days of filmmakers, where it's just like D.W. Griffith got a chance to make his movies, and Frank Capra and John Ford and John Huston. So it's trusting the filmmaker. The TV shows and the studios, just prior to this, unless you're a heavy hitter director, it would be, there'd be a lot of notes. Yeah. And a lot of notes are cross-purpose. They mean well,
right.
But, you know, it's like taking too many drugs. One drug does this and one drug does that. You put them together and it does something else that right. No one can foresee. And that's why committees are not great for making movies. It's a singular vision.
I think it's amazing. Like, you know, back in the 60s, you went from, you know, the Doris Day films to the Easy Riders, right? And that process is because, like, the studios, and I was like, well, no one's going to go see these Doris Day films anymore.
Yeah.
And they basically just said, they gave money to you know, these independent filmmakers, you know, the Marty Scorsese's and those guys, and they're like, make something, and that's how The Godfather got me, you know, or Coppola, you know. So
yeah, and Marty, you know, it's Taxi Driver is not a studio movie in any, you know, the same studio did Doris Day movies is not coming up with Taxi Driver. It's a particular vision of, and back then is like when the studio system was essentially dying.
There was no.
You know, and we don't know what to do. And then Easy Rider comes up, and it's like $300,000 movie makes more money than any of our other movies.
Yep.
Tap into that, I guess, but we don't know what that is. We have no idea. And it was such a great, you know, that book, Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, describes the time. And then all of a sudden they caught on, and now the superhero movies, even back then, the Supermans and the whatever, started to become the studio fare.
Yeah.
And the studios kind of got their power back because now they're making money again.
Yeah, Donna Smith has actually been on this podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So we talked about, you know, her first film was Raging Bull, right?
Oh, my God. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah,
masterpiece. And I was so fortunate to be able to work with Thelma and Marty. And every time there's a little moment off, I'll ask another question about Raging Bull.
Yeah,
and all that. It was very, and Marty for me too. When I was in film school, I'm trying to think of the name of the movie now. I saw it 30 times. New York, New York.
Oh yeah.
My friend was an usher at the Arlington Theater in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And so I didn't have any money, so he'd let me in and go see New York, New York, and it played for a while. And so I saw it like over and over again, and I really loved the way the movie was constructed. It was a musical, so that means he has the great love of that time frame, but he couldn't do the Doris Day, you know, a type of film, that treatment is that he needed to do that genre with real humans. Robert De Niro is a very flawed character. Liza Minnelli is a flawed character. They all have emotions and stuff like that. So you've never saw that in a movie musical before.
Sure.
You only saw the purified version of it.
Yep.
So it was so it hit the audience in the wrong way probably, but not me, because it was like, wow, that is a great idea. Uh-huh. And I love the spontaneity, the improv nature of what Marty does, and how Robert De Niro took that, and so I was endlessly fascinated. And then the idea that I get to work with him one day is just incredible.
Yeah, that's incredible. Great thing. It's just really amazing to work with your heroes and to see that that process. I find it fascinating. I think you've always seemed to you know, and it's clear now why that happened, is like you've always seemed to have some ideas about how to do something that's very interesting and do something, pull it off in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked, I'm good friends with Ben Grossman, as you know, and that's how we got to connect with each other. But he's always talked about the process of working with you on certain things. Obviously, he worked with you on a bunch of things, including Hugo. There's really sort of a fascinating part of taking that approach of how you want to make that look. I really want to start talking a little bit about the virtual production stuff that you guys did, because obviously, starting with, Jungle Book, or maybe it was before that.
It was long before that. It was actually...
When did you really start thinking about that idea?
Well, I worked on Harry Potter, which was not a pleasant experience for me, and I had to design the Quidditch scene, and so the only way to design it and figure out how to do it was to pre-visit.
Right.
And I don't like the idea of somebody else pre-visiting it, because they're not the filmmaker.
Sure.
And so they don't know to react to, well, this shot looks cool, and then I can't design anything without cutting it, so I need something to cut to actually create something to look at it as a whole and say it's working or it's not working, or it has pace or has rhythm or whatever else, because I'm interested in that portion of it. So I did that, but the frustration when I was doing it is that I would love to operate the camera, but I can't. So I have to tell somebody, the previs person who's operating controls, even though they're not creatively coming up with the shot, I am, it's never my shot. It's, you know, what lens do you have on? It's like, right. Well, they don't even know what the lens is. I mean, it's like, and it's like, well, you have to know what it is because then I need to be able to change it for other things. And
sure.
And what's the correlation between that? And they, you know, so it was like, well, there's a real hole in this process. So I did it and I did the best I could on it and all that stuff. And I enjoyed the editing because I could change the pace of it. And also I could predict what it's going to be like before we spent the money doing it. And I could right. back figure out, which I've done on Hugo and other movies
right.
from the previs, how to physically accomplish it. And so then Fade to Black, I got to do Aviator, which is a real lucky break for me, and
yeah.
I love doing it. And I had to shoot the plane crash.
Yep.
And now it's like, well, I'm now in charge of shooting the plane crash. I convinced them that I could do it. I've never shot one before, and so
right.
I need some experience doing it, and my only experience I have is live action. I need to physically operate the camera. I need to physically design every shot. I need to edit it mm-hmm. to even know that I'm making a fool of myself or not. So I got this thing called Motion Builder, which you may be familiar
yep.
with, and then Pan and Tilt Wheels, and somebody at Sony wrote a driver to allow the wheels to operate Motion Builder, and Sony was going off on a tangent doing something else for the Bob Zemeckis films, and I was going, this is a really cool thing if I could. So I had one guy, a guy named Oliver Hotz, is like the crew, and he uh-huh. would, you know, build the set in Maya, convert it to Motion Builder,
right.
and then the plane would just do very simplistic, just go from point A to point B. But it's the photography of it, the
yes.
counter moves and the things and the editing pace of it. And I knew that I had to recreate it in miniature. So there's certain shots I can't do that even if I like them in CG, I can't reproduce them on a miniature stage, or we shot a lot of it outside. So I... you know, had my Avid next to me, and me and one guy, and I'd operate every shot and go, let me try with a 14. And I'd create the rhythm, like Alfred Hitchcock says, you create the feeling of motion with a bunch of static shots because of the editorial rhythm of it. And mm-hmm. so just determine that work. So I basically now got experience by the nature of doing it this way, just shot after shot after shot, hating it, going, it's really stiff and shitty looking, mm-hmm. and I don't like it. And to like, oh, well, let me try this shot. Let me try that shot. And all of a sudden, you start to get years of experience by making a mistake and fixing them. And by the time I eventually showed Marty, he was like, yeah. And we'd change a couple things. But it was mostly like, well, here's an intact piece of work that I can now judge to be worthy to be in my film, where I couldn't before on storyboard frames and whatever else.
Sure, sure.
So I was like, well, this is an awesome way of working. And what would be even more awesome is, what if I was on a live action stage? What if I was in a motion capture stage where I can motion capture the camera? Because I was
right.
just doing Pan and Tilt Wheels.
But you were still more engaged than you would if you just told someone to do
something.
Oh,
yeah, no, I was designing
yeah.
the shot. It
yeah,
was
yeah,
like,
yeah.
that was my, what I said before with other people is that, you know, the process wears you down when you when you do an iteration.
Versions are slow between.
Slow in between. It's like, and I use the analogy, it's like trying to compose music, one note, wait 5 minutes, hit the other note, wait another 5 minutes, hit the other note, and say, well, what do you think? It's like, I don't know, I need to hear them together
right.
quickly to determine if that note was the appropriate. Now I have to go back and do the whole thing again.
Right.
So it's a really disjointed way of working, and that's where the whole concept of live interaction, reacting to what I'm seeing as you operate a live camera, you're continually doing stuff that is intuitive and not studied. Not.
Right.
So I determined when I finished it, I had success. The scene came out okay. Marty was happy, and people, you know, talked about it, that it was a cool scene. Even though I had no money whatsoever, I just shoot it in 7 days, and, you know, all that stuff, it still hit a nerve of some kind because it had this live action kind of quality and intensity to it, not a CG or a model photography
sure.
version of it. So I wanted to show Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what he was doing, you know, and I discovered that he was planning to do Battle Angel,
right?
Not Avatar. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, let me show you what I did. Let me show you the result. You would love this because he loves to operate.
Yeah.
He loves to do everything,
yes.
press every button, hit every knob.
Yeah.
He wants to do all those things. This is like made for you.
Right.
And you get to play and make a movie and then criticize it and go back and change it and edit it again. And do,
yep.
you know, so he funded me making the idea bigger.
Right.
So we went on a motion capture stage, and we kind of glued Motion Builder together with these other things and a pan and tilt wheel, and then, you know, essentially what amounts to a Steadicam, although we didn't physically use a Steadicam. Right. It was just somebody hand holding it. Then we clean up the curve and do Roll Killer to make it look feel like more like a Steadicam. So we did a kind of all of the things. And then Jim was so impressed with the manner of working that he said, well, I can make Avatar, you know.
Right.
That's the movie I want to make
more than
Battle Angel. So he scrapped he had like all these storyboards and big giant artistic pieces of things for Battle Angel, but he didn't write that. I mean, it was already a subject matter that was out there.
Right.
But Avatar is his own personal thing, and so I set up and showed him mm-hmm. how you use it. And
right.
it's basically you use it like a live action film.
Right.
And he's a real quick study. Mm-hmm. And once I showed him, you know, here's the possibilities and here's how you translate the dolly shot to this and whatever, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. He, you know, got it and said, I'm good.
Yep.
You know, I don't need you anymore. Even though he asked me to supervise the movie, it really wasn't a movie for me to supervise, especially then. I didn't really know that much about CG and everything.
Right.
So, and also I was working with Marty and I was going to do the next film. So I set up the virtual workflow for the movie,
sure.
the concept of it and how it would work. And then, you know, Glengarry came in afterwards when I left
yep.
to make it a more of a production model. But the impetus was Aviator.
Right.
Fixing a problem that I had, which is I want to operate the camera. I want to pick the lens choices. I want to pick the move. I don't want somebody else to do it. I don't want to go through an iteration loop. I want to be the iteration loop. Like,
right.
I don't like it. Lower it, lower it, lower it. Move to the right, move to the right. Good.
Right.
That's it. That's my iteration loop. I don't want to tell somebody that you interpret it and then you give me back something 20 minutes later or a week later,
right.
for that matter. So then... Fade to Black, I do the other Marty movies. Some I use kind of a pre-vizzy sort of mm-hmm. approach. Some things I would shoot in camera, you know, with a still camera to produce storyboard frames that were appropriate to, I can't draw,
right.
and I need to look through a camera to design a shot. So I would do that and make sketches of it. So I would, mm-hmm. that would kind of fill in the blanks because it cost too much money to build up the Avatar stage for 10
right.
shot sequence in a Marty movie. But then when Hugo came around, I needed to kind of make a more robust version of me and Oliver Hotz, what we did on Aviator. So I had like four or five people in England mm-hmm. Do it, and I would design every shot and photograph it. And then I was the second unit director, and I'd go off and shoot the things as well. So I was designing it for me to pull off. So it was,
sure.
That was fun and very intuitive for me to do it. And built a little miniature crane so I could do a crane shot and a thing with the physicality of what a crane looks like, even though it's in miniature, but I would know what I would do.
Yeah.
And then I would design shots for the main unit to do based on real equipment. And then I encoded all of the real equipment on the stage. So basically the stage became a previs stage as well mm-hmm. by moving the technocrane
right.
and moving the dolly all of a sudden because they were encoded. So now they are producing the shot. In essence. And so then John Favreau was interested in doing another movie. I think it was Magic Castle, I think, or something like that. It was some other Disney project where he was interested in the kind of the more like virtual shooting that you have a blue screen stage and you shoot a bunch of things and you add the largesse of the set.
Right.
So he asked me about it and I gave him a tour of what I did on Hugo, which is ultimately that. There were tons of green screen partial sets that became what the movie is.
Yep.
What Ben did a brilliant job mm-hmm. on and filling in all the backgrounds and things and all the designs of the shots. And we did a train crash, kind of reminiscent of the plane crash and the other one and all that stuff. So that was the basis of that. So now when he switched projects to Jungle Book, he asked me, because now it seemed like we're doing the Avatar approach mm-hmm. and who besides me is out there to reproduce what Jim Cameron even got credit for as if that was his idea to begin with.
Sure.
Like, here's what I want to do. You go figure it out for me. It was like, here's, I'm giving you this.
Right.
Then he made the film based on the gift that he was given of that thing. So I reproduced essentially what we did and then discovered at the end of it, And because I love that way of working, because I, you know, that's the way I create is this kinesthetic thing again, is I need to look through the eyepiece, figure out what I'm doing, figure out other possibilities. What's missing is being in the world, you know, being physically there. Now, I tested it when I did Avatar, but we didn't have the technology of VR glasses.
Right.
But we had Glengarry made up for me is back then they had glasses that had just little video screens in it. So you can see what it looks like, a 40-inch TV screen
in front
with glasses in front of you. Right. So we separated the two things out. So instead of getting the same signal, one came off of one computer, one came off another computer. Right. So it's in essence in 3D. Real big umbilical cord to go to a PC, and the gag worked, the idea worked. So that's in 2005.
Right.
So the idea of that I could walk around and be in the environment, even though I had a limited view, has value, but it wasn't practical enough to use it. But then when the Vive came along at the end of Jungle Book, then becomes a viable way of working. And that was the missing ingredient to then say, let's scrap Motion Builder and everything else. It wasn't being that well supported anyway. And it's very specific to that, and the game engines are becoming the, you know, were the appropriate vehicle for doing this. So it's like when we're going to do Lion King, let's create now our version of what the best virtual camera system is, or virtual workflow is. And then, you know, what I wanted to add back into it is the total analog quality that you get by having film professionals on a stage being able to communicate and go, move the dolly a little faster, a little slower, slower. Okay, that's good. About right around there. You know, and that, again, that iteration loop of a live person doing it. And not anybody can be the dolly grip. You can have a really bad dolly grip.
Yep.
Or somebody doesn't know what they're doing and they push too fast, too slow, and they don't know that the operator has to catch up and back pan so they can't be surprised when you move. You know, all that. So you need it. And then when you did focus pulls, it seems like, well, that's easy. You just say, I want to go focus from here to here. Well, there's an art form of how long, when to do it. And when you intuitively see the scene change, and now the focus of the scene is changing to another character, there's an art form of dialing that knob to be essentially what the audience is doing. It's like, I now want to pay attention to that. And that time frame and all that subtlety is art. And a talented focus puller. Tommy Tisch was Caleb's focus puller. We brought him in and immediately he was able to work on this thing because it's very intuitive. And Caleb Deschanel was very intuitive because he'd been shooting movies for 50 years, all on his great artistic intuition.
Right.
I'd move the camera here, I'd use this lens because the next shot I'm going to use that lens, and this style of this way I'm going to photograph this lens to the drum of the moment, and it's all based on the light. Now I can move the light and see that in real time and really lay down a template for what this shot should feel like. And if we do that at the end result and it looks photoreal, it will look like we really shot it, because everything about it is conceived in a live action sort of approach. So that was the evolution of the whole VR, you know, virtual shooting, is get the analog real live input that you could bounce off of back into the system that is basically doesn't want that. A computer doesn't want that. It wants to know exactly where I'm moving.
Right.
There's no analog version of that unless you hook up an encoder to it. And then all of a sudden now there is, because now it's in, it feels right. And then when you have a ballet of one guy on the dolly, the other guy on the crane arm, somebody else pulling focus and somebody else operating, the chemical mix of that, you know, take one's pretty crappy, but take seven is magic. And you go, well, let's do another one. And then all of a sudden, take eight isn't that anymore because you missed the magic, and you now it's take 14.
Right.
And then you do it again, and now it's take 21 is the one. And there are Jim Cameron used to call it snowflakes. Every shot is a snowflake. It's just different. You know, I moved a little faster, moved a little slower. Even though the object that you're photographing does exactly the same thing over and over again, you don't. Your interpretation changes and wanes over the day, and you have a different kind of feeling about something in the morning than you do in the afternoon.
Yep.
And that chemical reaction to things shows up. It gets transmuted onto the film. That is an intangible. You can't, you know, you can't bottle it up. It just is. You have to use this procedure to elicit it. You can't bottle, you can't artificially. Somebody asked me, you know, well, can't you artificially with computer intelligence? It's like, no, because it's all intuitive art. And I'm different after I eat a big lunch than I was right. before. If I'm pissed off at the guy next to me, it changes what I'm doing. You know, so, and all that stuff is part of the thing. And as filmmakers, you just say, I like that take. I don't know why that take. That goes in the movie.
Right.
And this one goes in the movie. All these other factors led up to it. So nothing is really mechanical. Everything is like jazz. You
right.
you play, and then you hear the other musician, and then you riff off of that, and this one riffs off of that. And all of a sudden, you create something that you never would have created in your own vacuum. You need the collaboration of others to produce it.
Sure.
And so you have to recreate it.
But, I mean, obviously, you know, animation has been doing this for a long time, but animation has a different feel to it, right? Animation doesn't have the same kind of cinematography that you were trying to recreate in Lion King. So the fact that Lion King is you're bringing back all the filmmakers into that process and making a film that is done using the exact same process they've done live action,
yeah.
Except they're making things that are 100% CG. Well,
what you're bringing back in is the intuitive art of it.
Right.
And you're finding a way to capture it.
Sure.
And the animation approach, you know, what I tell other people, because they do question, it's like, well, if you aim a camera at something, you will create a shot. Doesn't mean you're a cameraman, though. It doesn't mean that you're an artist. It
right.
means that you just aimed it, and yes, you created a version of it. But because there is no rhyme or reason to it, you just fell off the turnip truck that way
right.
and you did it. And instead of studying the art form and becoming intuitive about it, you are just finding a means to an end. So just because you can do it doesn't mean you're good at it.
Like right.
Everybody has an iPhone, so everybody's a cameraman.
Right.
But they're just not very good, you know.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And then if you see like Bob Richardson's iPhone, you know, videos there look like his movies. I mean, because
right.
he's – so it's the same. So it's not the device.
Nope.
It's the person behind the device. So the difference in our movie than other movies and animators, they've been animators and that's what they do very well. They're not cameramen necessarily. They're not editors necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
They're not filmmakers necessarily. They're really good at, you know, it's like asking the actor to photograph himself and edit his performance.
Sure.
If you're not a filmmaker, you're going to get a kind of a biased thing that's geared towards my character compared
right.
to the scene. So you don't notice it specifically. You just don't have the same feeling that I got when I saw The Godfather.
Right.
You have a different nulled, you know, experience. It's technically very good, looks great. I just don't have this emotion that I witnessed in other things. Because it didn't transmute the emotion of the collaboration of people who are really good at what they're doing artistically and have studied it for years and years and years and are just really good at it. And so that's what you miss and why you want to do it. And it seems like a pain in the ass. It's like, well, why would you bother doing it? You get it on the box with a mouse and you could do the same thing. It's like, you can't.
Right.
You can't do that. It's the same way with the music. It's like, yeah, you could do one note at a time with 5 minutes in between. You can do that. It just won't create jazz
because right.
you're not listening to that and hearing the other person and doing this. And you're doing very set, specific, intellectually wrought, not emotionally wrought opinions or feelings of how to frame something, how to light something, how it's going to affect the rest of the scene, what the rest of the moment's going to look like, and just the ability to walk around in that set and get these ideas, absorb these things around you that you'll use maybe four shots from now.
Right.
That stuff is what's missing when somebody isn't doing that, or you have 40 people doing it.
Right.
You know, you just don't get the continuity of the art.
No, but you guys made tools. You virtualized a crane. You virtualized everything, right?
Yeah, but we had a crane to virtualize it.
Yeah, you had a physical crane to virtualize.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Because that you can't fake.
No, it has a weight and feel.
It has a weight and a gravity to it. And the gravity and the inertia of starting and stopping is something that you could, if you can it, just doesn't have the momentary live emotional, I feel like I should move now type
right.
thing. You just don't. It becomes an intellectual, I'm moving on frame 27.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I have no idea what I'm moving on. I just feel it and I just do it.
What was it like for Caleb to be part of that? I mean, was it a hard transition or was it like very intuitive?
No, it was a very easy transition. I mean, he's a very bright guy too.
Sure.
So there's a part of him that I, Not everybody will gravitate towards it because they feel a little intimidated by it. But, you know, what makes good filmmakers is they're fearless. It's like, I'll try it. What the hell? You know, and if I hate it, I hate it. But, and I was there to kind of help him translate, here's what I want to do and here's the way we do that same thing and explain it in a way that is like, now that you explain it, it is the same exact thing that I've done. So as soon as you put the goggles on, you walk around and you go, okay, where would you put the camera? And he would go, well, I'll put the camera over here.
Right.
Okay, put a mark down. So a Ben and Magnobis made tools and put a mark down.
Right.
Okay, well then where would you put the other end of the crane?
Right.
Or the dolly track? And you go, over here. Like, right. Now he's off to the races. It's like, well, he's based on the input of what he's seeing.
Yep.
And it's like, well, the light is too high. I would then move it. And he moved it. It was like, oh, Jesus, I guess.
Yeah.
And now I'm just making a movie. Now I picked
And he also gave him more, you know, took off some of the shackles, right? Because he can move the sun, right?
Yeah. Well, what we found and what Caleb likes to talk about is, in the computer world, everything is perfect. You know, the sun stays in the same spot all the time.
Right.
In the real world, it doesn't. Right. You try, you aim for perfection, you get none of it. You get what you get.
Right.
And if you're good, you're able to corral what you do get and take advantage of it. But you take advantage of it saying, well, you know, when I shoot your end of the conversation, I have to shoot that between 10 and 11.
Right.
When I shoot the reverse, it looks like shit at 10 or 11 looking the other way. So I'm going to wait till, I don't know, 3 and 4, and I'll shoot the other side of the conversation there. And the clouds are different. The light's different. It's not the same altitude at 11 it is at here, but it cinematically works. Mm-hmm. And so Caleb thought, well, intellectually, we could keep the sun in the same place. Not that he wouldn't shoot the reverse anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wouldn't do that anyway, but discovered that every setup you would move the sun, even shooting in the same direction. It's like, well, now, you know, I'd want a little more dapple, so let me move the sun back here and let me get a little more dapple to trees and get this, because the shadow, I might want to tilt. Now that I see the shadow, I might want to tilt up from the shadow to the animal or whatever. Right. All of a sudden, you know, the spark of creativity starts to come back by responding to the very quick nature of those things changing. It's like, we'll keep on moving around, there.
Yeah.
But, you know. And that's why what's nice about it is you go past the mark and then determine that that mark is the mark.
Right.
As opposed to, I don't know if I should have gone a little further. It's like, no, you go past it. And, I keep on coming back to the same thing. Like an editor, I was talking to an editor, Walter Murch, actually, and I read in his book that what he would do before he'd make a cut is he would just put the brake on the moviola. And do it like 3 or 4 times and discover every time he felt there would be the cut is when he put the brake on. And when he found the consistent nature that all 3 times he did it, I'm sort of paraphrasing his thing, that's where the cut should be. It just felt that was it. And because he was able to go through it and, you know, one time he did it too late, not good enough, with it too early, not good enough. And he would always find that consistently he would hit that mark. And that's the same way with this, as your analog, move it fast, go past the mark. Now it's too much. Go back here. That's okay. This is exactly right.
Right.
But you have experienced it as opposed to when you get one iteration back from a CG artist, it's like, did you go past it?
Right.
Do you want me to go past it? It's like, well, I don't know if I want you to go past it. I don't know. I'm only viewing the one choice.
Yeah.
And I would have moved it past to see if this was the best choice. It may be, I don't know.
Right.
And then, so that's what you get from this. And, you know, and for CG artists, if they wanted to do it and use this thing, they will become cameramen. They will become good at it because they'll have the constant filter going, that looks like crap. You know, why does it look like crap? Because the sun's too high.
Right.
Well, why is the sun too high? It's like, well, let me look at my favorite movie. It's like, oh, well, everything I liked that was shot at this time of day and everything I liked here was shot.
Right.
So, we discovered that we would go back and Caleb discover that I'm just changing the light every shot, just like I would be if I shoot in the scene live.
Right.
If I shoot an hour from now, the light's different.
Right.
And it's the same scene, same moment in time, but it's different. And I liked it.
Yeah.
And I don't like it when I could have had it perfect.
Right.
So the imperfection is what I'm after.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very good way of seeing it, and the fluidity and the analog nature of it is what's really going to make it feel more cinematic, right? We've gotten so used to that language of cinematography that's been done on live action for so long that if we continue to use the same process, we're going to more likely hit that cinematic feel.
Well, right? It's a sense memory of what looks like a real movie.
Right, exactly.
And if you're trying to make something look like a real movie, then you have to use the same vocabulary and methodology of that. And what I discovered more on this film, but more supported what I felt like, is that I can't improve on filmmaking. I can't. There's 100 years of history of why we stage things the way we stage them, what the process is. You come in the morning, everybody walks around with their script. It's like, try it at the door. Okay, you're going to come in and put your thing down over here. And now the other actor sees it. So you need to do that to rough it in. Mm-hmm. And then you... while you're roughing it in, you're in the set, and you're kind of going, well, okay, if I was going to do that shot, that's kind of boring. Maybe I should cover it from here, so let's move this wall out. You know, and all of a sudden, you start to hone in on the scene.
Sure.
And then you shoot it five or six times and go, you know, take seven was the best one. Take nine was the best one. Mm-hmm. I think those two are the ones I'm going to print. And when you go to edit them, you go, you know, try take seven. It's like, take nine worked. So Something about the methodology that we've chosen to make a movie is correct. Because evolution would have changed it.
Sure.
We would have fixed it.
Yeah.
But you haven't. And you haven't for a reason. And then we discovered in the process of doing this that don't fight how we have made movies for 100 years. Take advantage of it.
Yeah.
Because that is the evolution that survived. And I can't fix it. I can't make it better. It's like, well, you know, you shouldn't have to do seven takes. It's like, well, I need to. Because I need to experiment to find the right chemical mix that says that's the shot.
Right.
That's the one I want.
Right.
And I couldn't articulate it before I did it. I know kind of the playground, but I, you know, something magically happens. Everything falls into place on one take, and that's the one that's in the movie.
Do you feel that, I mean, obviously you've done this, and I definitely feel that this is going to be a tool that a lot of people are going to be using in the future. I really strongly believe that. When you were still working on Jungle Book, and I was like, that's the way that people are going to make movies. What do you think is going to happen next? What do you think the next evolution of this? Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, the next evolution, for one, is, I mean, there's a multifaceted way of answering the question. One of them is, and what I am excited about, is that as a filmmaking teaching tool,
yes,
to experiment and to have the access to a live action stage within a computer and a very sort of inexpensive venue, mm-hmm. will teach somebody what took me years to learn.
Yes.
To before I got even decent at it, to be allowed to professionally pursue it. You have to, you know, have some aptitude, but two, a lot of practice.
Mm-hmm.
So now in film schools, in your private home off your laptop, you could start to create, and you could now become a cameraman.
Mm-hmm.
You could become a dolly girl. You could become all the various things and make a mistake and feel free to make a mistake because it doesn't cost you anything. And when I was starting, going off a little bit of a tangent, when I was starting, your opportunities were few and far between, so you couldn't risk something too much because if you blew it, you'll never get asked to do it again.
Right.
So you didn't do your personality's version of how you would do it. You did the more tried and true, safe version.
Right.
So there's that portion of it. Now you get the Mozart to emerge because I'm going to try this. That doesn't work. I'm going to try that.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden you get your 1,000 or 10,000 hours of experience. So there's that portion of it.
Yeah.
So that means filmmakers, as they grow up and do it, will become better and better and more attuned to it. The part that's going to change, I think, is that now you could build a bridge so people who are traditionally trained could now work in this medium.
Yeah, it was just a black box before.
Before,
right?
It was a black box and a black box operator,
right,
who... some had a very great artistic aptitude for camera and for staging and lighting, and some didn't. But the venue that they're using is too myopic for them to be good at it.
Right.
Without just a natural aptitude. That because you don't see all the possibilities and then choose this. You only see what you see through the window. And then you pick one because you got to pick one because they need to see it in dailies. And
right.
So you just pick one. And then all of a sudden just sort of stays in the movie. But it's not like the inspired version of it. So there's that aspect of it. There's now a Caleb. Mm-hmm. Never had any experience doing this kind of what seems very technical, be totally creative and be able to flex his artistic muscles in the way that the end result looks like he photographed it.
Yeah.
Looks like the Black Stallion. It looks like the natural. Looks like
yes.
those sensibilities. So the fact that also now what's changed with ray tracing and all the various things is that we're actually simulating real life with such fidelity that it looks like real life if you do it correctly.
Yeah.
You know, and what I discovered, even on the process of this film, because I needed to crack a particular code that I was having difficulty with, is lighting. Mm-hmm. It's like, my theory is, I should light in the computer like I light on stage.
That's what we do.
And you know, not to have a shameless plug here, yeah. but, and part of lighting is move it far back, up higher, lower. Yep. Let me see what it does.
And having that be a feedback loop.
It's a feedback loop yep. makes me have experience lighting this scene that I wouldn't get by taking one stab at it and calling it a day.
Right.
And not knowing that it could have been better, not knowing. And, you know, you only learn by trying something and failing. And mm-hmm. then you learn that don't do that. And I'm going to now do the things that work. So that portion of it. And so I got Cinema 4D mm-hmm. and I started moving lights around. It's like, well, I would light the scene with a 20x20, you know, light source. And yep. I would, here was the area shadow. And okay, that's an area light. All right. Well, I didn't know what the hell that was before. But it works the same way I think it does.
Sure.
And so now I can light the way I would light on a stage, and Caleb could light the way he lights on a stage, yep. and the end result will look like it has the same natural light simulation abilities that I'm used to.
Right.
And be able to recreate it and artistically use it the way I would use it on a stage if I was good at it. And right. so the fact that you can crack that code, and now it's accessible. Now I could be a CG lighter because I know how to light it.
Right.
And what I have that other people don't have is I've, you know, 35 years experience lighting
Absolutely.
Real things and what it looks like and why I chose that unit as opposed to it's just a thing that I didn't know why I picked an area light from a spotlight, from an infinity light, from a whatever.
Right.
There is very specific artistic reasons why I picked yep. them. They're not arbitrary. They are. So now what changes the paradigm a little bit is that people who've had this wealth of experience in real life can recreate it faithfully. When you see some of the shots that we did in Lion King, pretty hard to distinguish it from the real thing. I mean, I think yeah. it looks real, it feels real. The wind's blowing, the leaves, the trees look real. The light is a perfect ray traced simulation
right.
of what it would really look like, and your eye gets fooled by it. It
right.
just looks like, well, it looks like every picture I've ever seen.
Sure.
And now it's all art. Now that you could create real life, it's not good enough just to create it. Now, artistically photograph it.
Right.
Make it feel like it's part of a movie. Make it live in a cinema world, not just, isn't it, all right, clever, I can make something look real. You have to make it look real good now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not just good enough to make it look real. It's got to look really good.
Yeah. It's like, it's the same example. Everyone has a phone in their pocket, but you got to take a good picture, right?
Yeah, well, people thought, you know, and this is the illusion of the art form. When you have a high ASA film, you could shoot with available light. It's like, well, that's not available light. That's available exposure.
Right.
It looks like crap.
Sure.
You light. A light is artistic. Light is not just, oh, I just needed something to expose, and then I photograph you with, you know, a terrible looking light.
Sure.
And call it a day. It's like, well, no, it looks like crap.
I mean, right.
You
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
And that's where, you know, you get into that you're not creating real life. You're creating cinema life.
Right.
Cinema life that every movie you've ever seen, every Godfather movie you've ever seen, all that stuff. I mean, it's artificially lit to look like it's not artificially lit.
Yep.
But it's a 20K through a window. It's not, they didn't wait for the sun to be in the right spot and,
right.
and all that stuff. You get good at it. Gordon Willis got really good. Caleb is spectacular at it. Bob right. Richardson's spectacular at it.
Sure, sure, sure.
And there's many cameramen who are, you know, but those are the guys I work with. And, you know, I marvel at their eye that's been cultured over years and years of experience that now can also work in this world. And so now it becomes a choice. It's so much easier now to shoot a scene that was much more difficult to shoot, but I really needed the realism of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I can shoot it in another way. And then because I have more time on the top of the mountain before the sun goes down, I could shoot better shots. I could mm-hmm. shoot more interesting things. And so what it improves, the technology improves, the creative output of it, that better films emerge from it, the soft science of it,
mm-hmm.
people have now more experience shooting even that scene, because you could shoot it three times if you wanted to.
Right.
In a live action film, you can't. So that future is, well, once you have it, it's hard to deny it.
Right.
You can't say, well, let's not do it that way. Because before it's like, I want it to look real. CG looks like, you know, CG, so it doesn't look real. I mean, the first thing that happened when CG started to look real is Cars.
Right.
You know, where, man, it looks better than I could light a car, for sure, right. Because I don't see the rig that I'm lighting the thing
with. You know, it's interesting you said that. I did a Scion commercial that was souping, and the director decided to assign a DP to work with us on it. And it was really, he was a really great DP. And honestly, as someone who's a lighter, CG lighter, right, I really appreciate it, because what he basically did is, well, if I'm going to shoot this, I would use, you know, this Fisher light. I'd use this kind of stuff. And the director who assigned him was like, you can do, imagine you have an unlimited lighting budget, but you still have the physicality. You still have to, you can't make a 500-foot Fisher light, right? You can only, they only come in 40 feet or 80 feet or whatever. So he set up all these lights for us in the thing. I was like, that's how I would do it. Yeah. And it was really cool. And then there was another thing he did where we had a close-up shot on a bumper. You know, that typical scene. And he said, you know, the reason this looks CG is that it's a perfect reflection of a horizon line. It says, and what I always have the problem is I have, you know, craft services or something in the back of the reflection. And so we actually added just a little bit of stuff in the background just to break it up and give it just a little bit more sense of realism. And it totally helps.
It reminds you of a shot you've seen for real. So then it's real. It's a magic trick to make something look real.
Yeah.
And in a movie, a magic trick is, you know, what the actor's saying, what the background looks like, all that stuff. That's why you want realism in the extras, you know, drinking coffee in the background,
right,
to create the illusion that it's real. It reminds you of something you've seen before.
Right.
And that's what you need to do in this.
Yeah.
And if you see a robot in the background doing something mechanical, it's like, well, it's not good enough that it's just there. It needs to be dirty. It needs to be, they need to do something surprising. And who would do that? I did it one time in a commercial that Jon Favreau seemed to like this story. You know, you're still always striving to create the illusion that something's real, and you just need some tricks to do it. And I did a model shot that felt like a helicopter, but it still wasn't exactly, you know,
right.
For me, I can never really quite get it exactly right. I wasn't shooting through, you know, a 1,000 feet of atmosphere and whatever, some intangible.
Mm-hmm.
And I added a little helicopter shadow at the bottom of frame that would just peek in like a helicopter blade. So all it did was the same shot, and you just see a reflection that shouldn't be there if you did it in CG.
Right.
What idiot would do that?
Yeah.
And it convinced people going, I don't know if that's real. That must be real, because they used the shot, but this was before you could paint things out.
Right.
So it was like, well, you know, it's got to be real because of the shadow.
Right.
That was artificially put in to create the illusion that, what idiot would actually do that without, you know, if you didn't need to.
Right, right, right.
And you find that you do that like that all the time. This is a side story, but it's kind of the same lines. Dante Ferretti, spectacular production designer that I got to work with a bunch of times.
Sure.
He was lamenting that he had this this director that was, you know, couldn't make up his mind. He had to build a kitchen for, I don't remember what the movie was or if it was a commercial, but he was a particularly, you know, no, it's not, I don't like it. It doesn't feel real. You know, he's kept on complaining, and, you know, he changed one thing, and, you know, Dante's pretty specific about what he builds. This is the vision of it.
Right.
And he decided what he would do, he would like move like some picture like 2 feet to the left or something like that, just some inconsequential thing. And then he had this special effects guy make a gas line that worked, and he fried up garlic in a pan just before the director came in.
Okay.
And so the director came in and went, because he, you know, felt like a real kitchen to him.
Right.
He smelled it. And he went, it's perfect. I love what you've done to it. He did nothing to it. He just created the illusion that it must be real because it smelled real.
Right.
And that's that
wow.
That metaphor, that thing is kind of what we do. You add something that you wouldn't expect only in a real thing to convince you that it must be real.
Interesting.
And it's all we do in a movie, really, by performances, by costumes, by, you know, sets, by aging sets, properly by putting reflections of other, you know,
stuff
in the bumper.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, you could
it a Schmutz pass.
Yeah. Literally. Yeah. And that's why something's too perfect in CG, which is very easy to get, very hard to get imperfection.
Uh-huh.
You get a perfectly straight line. Well, if you ever look at a straight line in real life, it's not very straight. It's really jagged. But in the computer, it's razor sharp. Yeah. So the sum total of razor sharp stuff looks, it's like, it just doesn't look real. I don't know why. I can't tell you why. But then you discover if you blew it up, it's like, oh, it's not, it's perfect.
Right.
This table is round, looks round, but when you actually, you know, zoom in on the edge of it, it's really rough. It's really not perfectly round. It's really not perfectly smooth. It's, and so that you notice subconsciously.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. Well, I think this is great, Rob, because I think this is, you know, it reaffirms all of my suspicions I've had all these years, and hearing you talk about it and how you went through that process is really a great story. And I also think you're right. See, we're going to simulate filmmaking so much more. It's going to enable so many more people to learn that language, which is a really good thing.
And make more truthful movies because the truth, I mean, at some point, once you're able to recreate something, now show me something cool in it. I mean, I believe that you made the Africa, but now show me a scene.
Right.
Because I at some more, you know, I could buy a book on it, but I really now entertain me with something. So that comes next once you break the hurdle of this. And that's what's going to happen in the future. And I didn't touch about the video wall and the ability to do things in real time on a video wall will also change filmmaking.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it slow and coming because it's starting to pick up steam, but with the game engine, with V-Ray, with the ability to see real-time ray tracing and things like that, you will be able to shoot a live composite with the fidelity of real life and the ability to move the camera and do anything you want without it being so studied like a storyboarded sequence is.
Sure.
It'll be much more fluid. And the fact that you can make every driving scene look much more realistic, anything that's outside the window look much more realistic, and all the stuff that you can do, you can't not use it once it's built, once it's created. And you're using the technology that was groundbreaking a few years ago will be commonplace.
Yeah,
it'll be just how we make a movie.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of the producers on a short that we did about 5 years ago called Construct, where we were doing the real-time ray tracing. And it was exactly that. It's like, we got the real camera, we're physically moving it around, we got real actors reacting to this, and we're doing real lighting all at once. And so suddenly it's like, oh, okay. Because even inside of Motion Builder, you were just dealing with gray shaded, not too realistic. Yeah. You get the motion, you get the framing, but you don't really know the composition, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was...
Well, the composition now gets aided by light.
Yes,
blocking by lighting. Gets aided by light.
Yes.
It's like, I want to stage you in shadow. And then when you walk out and there's going to be a certain impact, and if I don't get the impact because I don't see it, I don't know exactly how to frame it, but if I saw it, I would know how to frame it.
Yeah.
And the speed at which you reveal somebody in and out of shadow and stuff like that. So the lighting now becomes an integral part of the composition of a scene as it does in real life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or real cinema life.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, we've gone well over an hour, but it's been a fabulous conversation. So I don't want to take too much more of your time, but thank you so much for doing this.
Welcome.
This is great. It was fantastic work that you guys did, and really groundbreaking technology that's coming out there. And I think you're right. It's completely enabling that, that creative flow much more than ever before. So
more films would be more exciting to watch. I think.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, Rob.